Well, it's so good to speak to you during this Christmas carol service, and really a privilege to be speaking to three different locations at once. So glad that you're joining us if you're at Shoreham or the racecourse on this 23rd of December. This message is the fourth of a four-part series. All of the Sundays in December, we've been taking a part of the Christmas story and doing our best to learn some applications for it for our own lives. And today it's the fourth and final part. It's the story of the wise men, or the magi, or sometimes called the three kings. And I'm going to refer to that in this sermon. You've heard the story read to you just now. And actually, the story as we read it in the Bible may sound less familiar to you than some of the more famous images that you might get on Christmas cards or chocolate boxes or Christmas movies or whatever other kind of cultural images we have that refer to Christmas. But there's a bit of a problem right there, because what we've inherited over the generations, over the centuries, is a whole package of Christmas ideas that are actually at least slightly a distortion of the true historic picture of Christmas that we get from the biographies of Jesus in the Bible. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John tell the story of Jesus' life. And Matthew and Luke especially talk about the beginning, talk about his birth. And the story they tell is very vivid. It's very real. It's very in line with his accurate history from the time, from other sources from the time that speak of the events of the day. And it's a long way away from some of the images that you might get on Christmas cards that are practically, you know, thatched cottages with snow on them and Mary and Joseph inside. In fact, I was looking just this last week at something that happened earlier this year that rather makes the same point. There was a church in Spain where there's a religious icon showing a kind of an imagined face of Jesus Christ in Zaragoza in Spain. And you can see on the screen here this image of Jesus that's preserved in this icon that is a little bit tarnished. You can see it's kind of been affected by age. It's got some blotches on it where the paint has worn away. And a well-meaning and very devout lady tried to restore the image and try and make it look better. And the job that she's done can be seen here, where she's basically managed to make Jesus look more like a baboon. And that is, in some ways, kind of a bit of an allegory of what happens when well-meaning religious people over the years try to kind of add a little bit to the Christmas story and make it a little bit more pretty and pleasant. You get quite a long distance from the historical facts that the Bible presents us with. And I want to stress the fact the Bible does present us with a story that's supposed to be historical. It's not presenting a myth or a legend. It's presenting us with a Jesus who was rooted in history, where events that really could well have taken place took place. And in fact, even the story of these wise men traveling from the east is very easy to take seriously when you consider some of the facts. For example, it doesn't say anywhere that there were three. I mean, there could have been three, but we don't know precisely. It just says there were wise men, or magi. Magi means great ones, and it would have been a name given to great scholars who would have studied science and especially would have studied the heavens. And I mean by that, you know, the stars, the planets, the heavenly bodies that kind of weave their patterns in the world and were seen by night. And wise men would have spent time studiously observing the sequences and the patterns so as to understand the world better in a very scientific way. Now, then they may as well also have tried to judge the outcomes of historical events and human relations by what they saw in the heavens. They might have said, well, this happens here as a sign of something that's going to happen on planet Earth. And in fact, that's exactly what is happening in this story. They've seen a star rise, some kind of wonderful sighting in the heavens has caused them to consider that perhaps something great is happening. What's interesting is that astronomers who know about patterns of heavenly bodies have said that around the time of 7 BC, there would have been a coming together of Jupiter and Saturn, and that Mars as well would have come into a similar position, forming a kind of a rich triangular shape. And this isn't exactly, we don't know exactly what happened, but it's one good guess to say that they may have seen something in the heavens that would have got their attention at least and made them consider that something great is about to happen. I mean, these were stargazers that took such things seriously when they did. And of course, they also lived in a place which may well have been touched by those who understood the stories and prophecies of the Old Testament. See, the Hebrews, the Jewish people, had traveled as far as Babylon when they were taken out of Jerusalem hundreds of years before. And so these writings of the Old Testament would have even reached them. One of the famous writings of the Old Testament is found in the book of Numbers, and it refers in Numbers chapter 24 to a future king who God would raise up, a future leader of the world who would be born to the Jewish people. And as it says in verse 17, I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel. Now, I haven't got time to go into some of the other history from the time, but the main thing to bear in mind is that the idea of a great world leader, a great king who would be born amongst the Jews and who would be referred to in language like this, a star, a great star rising, well, that was well known in the time. It was something that would have characterized the hopes and dreams of many of the Jewish people, and those ideas would have spread even far out into the east, into Babylon. And so these magi may well have heard such things, been exposed to those kinds of great prophecies, see this star pattern in the heavens, and start to think, well, there is a future king about to be born to those Jewish people. We must travel and see whether he's coming. So I'm just trying to give you some idea of some of the historical patterns that might help us to understand the kind of reality behind this massive part of the Christmas story. Because truth is, they were looking for a kind of a reason, a hope, a purpose to history. They were looking for something that would give meaning to life. Now, they were stargazers, and they were fascinated with presumably with astrology and perhaps looking at the stars to try and judge what would happen to them in their own lives, like many people do today. I mean, people in Brighton and Hove, many would still do such things. They would look at the stars, look at zodiacs and horoscopes and so on. That still happens in all kinds of ways in our present day. But these guys hadn't found any ultimate answers through that. They hadn't found through that their sole desire for truth and meaning in life had been satisfied by stargazing. They're still looking for something great. They're still looking for a purpose and a hope to world history. They're looking for a purpose and a hope for their own lives. In that respect, they're no different than any of us, really. Because I think, if we're honest, we need to have a sense that life means something, that life is going somewhere, that there's a meaning and a purpose to our lives. People who don't have a sense of purpose and meaning to their lives, they either have to ignore that need and pretend it isn't there, or they have to fall into genuine despair and even a sense of suicidal depression. Well, there's no meaning to life. There's no purpose to life. So perhaps we spend more of our time just squashing that need, pretending it isn't there and hoping that it will go away. But if we stop and reflect, could we really exist? Could we really get through life knowing deep down that there's no meaning in life? There's nothing. There's no purpose to the world? There's no design. There's no future. There's no end in sight. It's just a huge random accident. It's genuinely just chance. The fact that we're even here. These kind of surprise beasts that we are. These organisms that have arbitrarily just kind of developed out of the slime. Not because of any design, but just sheer accident. Well, if that's true about us, then it means that life really does have no meaning. If we're just the products of chance and nothing else, it sucks all the sense of purpose and meaning out of life. And truth be told, I don't think that we do very well without some sense of meaning. We long to know why we are here. We long to know what's it all for? What's it all about? So I see these wise men as searchers who were searching for something true, something great, some great purpose to the world. Maybe this king arising in this distant land of Judea will be the answer to world affairs, the answer to life. And so they travel, they search. Maybe that describes you. Maybe you're someone who searched and sought out for long, long years of your life answers, truth. Maybe that's even brought you through this year. Maybe that's how you describe yourself even at this carol service. You're wondering about the truth. You're perhaps even considering Jesus himself. Of course, the interesting thing is that when they reach the center, when they reach Jerusalem, what they find is a group of people who are not all that excited about Jesus being born. Now, it does say that they were troubled. It says in verse 3, when Herod and the king heard this, he was troubled and all Jerusalem with him. But I put it to you that Herod was troubled because he felt threatened. He knew that a king coming into the world spelt the end of his kingdom, and so he wasn't excited. And in that respect, Herod isn't that different to us either. Because although we might crave meaning, hope, purpose, truth, we might think, if only I knew what the purpose to life was, and if only I knew that life had meaning, does anybody know what we're living for? If we're honest, we have to accept that we might not like the meaning if we were to discover it. We might find that the meaning of life is something that really doesn't appeal to us. I think that's true of so many people. They come into close contact with truth they've been looking for, and then they decide they don't really like the truth, and so they pretend the truth isn't there. That's certainly what Herod's doing. He's trying to remove the whole idea. He wants to finally wipe Jesus out of the whole story. And then you get people like these priests and scribes who are different. They're different than Herod. They haven't got the power to destroy Jesus for a start. But their attitude is that they're kind of just not interested. They kind of don't show any fascination. I mean, these magi have traveled literally hundreds of miles through desert to get to Jesus. Whereas these scribes and chief priests, they live in Jerusalem. Now, I've been to Jerusalem and I've been to Bethlehem. Seriously, they're about 4, 5, 6 miles away from each other. They're about 2 hours' walk. You're on a donkey, you could get there in a couple of hours. It's not a long journey. It was long for the wise men. It was nowhere near long for the chief priests. And yet, they don't want to go. They don't even want to see. They're not even interested. That is fascinating. Why would they not even want to investigate the birth of the Messiah for whom they've waited hundreds of years? I wonder if it's simply that they were so over-familiar. They'd grown up with these stories. They'd heard them from their mothers and fathers. They'd read these books, and to the point where they kind of saw it as rather belonging to the past. And we don't belong to the past. We belong to the present. We are superior to the past. These old things that are written, that we've grown out of that. That's from a different era. We're sophisticated now. We belong to the modern age. I was reading the publishings of the 2011 census that have only recently started to come out. And where they refer to religion and religious beliefs, it's fascinating to see Brighton and Hove becoming known as one of the most secular cities in the whole of England and Wales, the whole country. You've got places like, further out into other parts of the country where people are saying, yeah, we're Christian. The majority of people still saying they're Christian. In Brighton and Hove, it's way under 50%. And I think maybe that's a good thing because it shows that there's greater honesty in Brighton. There's a greater acceptance of the fact, we just don't see ourselves as religious at all. But I think that part of the reason people will say that is because they're convinced in themselves they've outgrown it. We've gone past it. That belongs to the past. Christianity is from the past in the same way that witches and cauldrons are in the past. It's medieval. It's kind of outdated. It's kind of backward. It belongs to a pre-scientific age. It's no good to us anymore. But when you stop and ask, how has Christianity been actually disproved? How is it shown to be false? Well, the answers are very flimsy. They don't come very fast, and we find it very hard to say why we think Christianity is definitely false. Well, there isn't any absolute proof. There's no definite certainty we can. But it just seems from the past. It's from the past. It's from the past. And so we reject Christianity on the same grounds that I might reject the jeans that I've still got in my drawer at home, but I wouldn't wear because I wore them 5 years ago. They're from the past. They're not false. They're not false jeans. They're just old jeans. They don't belong to this time, and so I don't have them now. You can do that with jeans. You can do that with, you know, fashion, but you can't do that with truth. If something's true, it's true today, just as it was true 500 years ago. And yet we're so familiar. We're familiar to the point of contempt. You know that expression, familiarity breeds contempt. You can grow up with something, saying, well, I've grown up with Christian. I've grown up in a so-called Christian nation. I know Christianity. Let me suggest to you that you might say that you know Christianity when in fact you don't know Christianity at all. You know a version of it. I went to a Roman Catholic school, and I remember talking to my friends when I was in my late teens, talking to them about Jesus. And they would say, no, don't talk to me about Jesus. I know all about Jesus. I know all about Jesus. And I knew when they said it that they didn't really know him at all. What they knew was a Christian upbringing, a Catholic upbringing. They didn't know Jesus. They rejected Jesus because of an experience they'd had that reminded them of Jesus. It's a little bit like an inoculation. Do you know this this medical thing? The way that an inoculation works, a vaccination works, is you get given a weak version of a disease so that your immune system is sharpened, so that when the real version of disease comes, you're quick to reject it. Your body has been tuned in to that kind of thing, and it rejects it quickly because it thinks it's seen it before. When the truth is, what it's had before is just a weak version. I tell you, religion is like that. Religion, maybe even a religious upbringing, can be like a vaccine. You can be vaccinated against Jesus and think, well, I've had Jesus before. I've seen Jesus before. Thank you very much for the carol service. I know all about Jesus, though, because I've seen Christianity before. I've had a bit of Christianity when I was young, and I reject it. No, listen, you're rejecting a weak version, but you're unfortunately throwing out Jesus at the same time, and Jesus and religion, Jesus and a religious upbringing, Jesus and even a Christian upbringing are very different. And these magi maybe understood that better than the chief priests, better than the scribes, better than Herod. They understood there was something special happening. There was something extraordinary happening. And they were prepared to travel so far, to go through so much, to find this special thing, whereas others would not even cross the road to find him. And we do that. We find it so hard to receive the thing that could be the most important thing in the world, even when it's happening just down the road. The Son of God being born down the road. Not interested. Not interested. I just urge you to consider Jesus more carefully than that. To consider who he is. Perhaps like many other parts of the world today, where Christianity is coming to life in a remarkable way. See, we're used to thinking maybe in cultures in the West that Christianity is a kind of a Western European kind of thing. And we see that Christianity is kind of dying out. Churches are shrinking in the West. And so maybe it's dying. Maybe it's the end of Christianity. It's all going. The truth is that around the world, Christianity is advancing at an extraordinary pace. The Christian World Encyclopedia says that 115,000 people become Christians every day. In developing countries, people are becoming Christians at such a rate that it overtakes the birth rate. That is the trend on a global scale. Maybe in some Western countries, churches are shrinking, but globally, Christianity is on an incredible rise. A world-renowned sociologist called Philip Jenkins wrote a book a few years ago called The Next Christendom that pointed this out. He's saying that it's inappropriate to see it as a Western thing versus the rest of the world. He's saying, no, Christianity is marching forward globally. It's just Western Europe that seems to be unaware of this. And there are many other books increasingly coming out making the same point. And when I think of that, it reminds me of these wise men who are hungry for Jesus, who come from distant lands to investigate, to find out. Whereas those who've grown up, we've grown up with Christianity, we've grown up with all this stuff, we're not interested. We know about him, but they may not know about him. They're overfamiliar. They're unimpressed. They're not interested, even when the Son of God is being born down the road. Let me ask you, have you considered that possibly the true answer to life, the meaning of the universe, and the one who can satisfy the desires of your heart is to be found in that religion that you rejected years ago because it just seemed too overfamiliar? It doesn't seem exotic enough, perhaps. But Jesus himself is the great answer, the great fulfillment of our longings and our dreams. And you need to find him as much as anybody does. And you will find him to be true. You'll find him to be a joy-giving, peace-giving satisfier of your soul. That's what he's come claiming to be. The Bible says that Jesus, the Son of God, came unto his own, but his own did not receive him. And it could be that you've been overfamiliar with Jesus Christ, but it's because you haven't seen who he really is. Let me ask you to consider, what was it about him that drew these men from so far away? They came saying, we will worship him. We'll put our gifts before him. We'll set our lives before him. We could be kings in our own land. We could be great leaders. We are great ones in our own world. We're magi. But they were prepared to come and lay their lives down humbly before him and say, you're the king. You're the Lord. Our kingdoms don't come first. Your authority, your rulership, your government is what matters to us. Be the king over our lives. Be the Lord. And truth is, the more you see in Jesus, the more you look at him, the more you see his love, his mercy, his greatness, his glorious sacrifice for our sins upon the cross, and his resurrection from the dead, the more you understand him to be alive today and destined to rule, the more actually you're willing to give your life. You're willing to trust your life to him because you find him to be more valuable than anything else in the world. And so you give other gifts to him gladly, knowing that he'll satisfy you in greater ways than anything in this world.